Syrian refugees attacked while fleeing across the Mediterranean.
They rammed this boat intentionally, according to all the survivors I've spoken to, yelled as the boat was sinking, "Let the fish eat your flesh," and were laughing as the boat was sinking to the bottom of the sea with everybody below deck instantly doomed. So these were people who wanted to see all those refugees die in front of them.
That's Melissa Fleming. We talk with her about her book, A Hope More Powerful Than the Sea, One Refugee's Incredible Story of Love, Loss, and Survival. Then Alan First returns with a new thriller about the French Resistance.
I just like the idea. It's a very old-fashioned idea in fiction and novels of the savior, of a guy or woman. Because there are a lot of strong women in this book. People who take it upon themselves to fight against evil.
The book is A Hero of France. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. You can also hear us at PRX. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. On March 6, Donald Trump reinstituted his travel ban on Muslim countries. Iraq was dropped from the original list, but Syria remained. While no Syrian refugees have ever carried out a terrorist attack in the U.S., they are fleeing terror and destruction in their own country. Terror from bombs dropped by Russia, the U.S., and their own government. Destruction of their homes and communities by both government troops and the opposition. Some of those opposition forces are being supported by the U.S., despite their record of terrorism. So the Syrian refugees flee all sides under terribly dangerous conditions. Already this year, 2,000 refugees have drowned in the Mediterranean, and the year is just 2 months old. Today we hear the story of a young Syrian refugee who survived a harrowing journey across the Mediterranean Sea from Turkey to Italy. She was one of about 25 survivors out of 500 whose boat was deliberately attacked by smugglers. Her fiancé, the love of her life, did not survive. She floated in the sea for days carrying two babies in her arms whose parents had handed them to her before they drowned. Her name is Doa Al-Samel, and her tale of incredible courage and heroism is told by my guest, Melissa Fleming, in her book, A Hope More Powerful Than the Sea, One Refugee's Incredible Story of Love, Loss, and Survival. Melissa Fleming is a spokesperson for the Refugee Agency of the UN, the UNHCR. Melissa Fleming, welcome to Writer's Voice.
It's great to be with you.
You are the chief spokesperson for the UNHCR, the UN High Commission on Refugees. You first told Doa's story on the TED stage, and I watched your presentation there, your talk. You say there that you ask each refugee, what did you take when you fled? And I wanted to first ask you, why do you ask that question?
Well, you know, I think it's very telling when you ask a refugee what they fled, because it shows actually what means most to them. So when you're about to lose everything, potentially even, you know, your family members, you don't know, you're in such a state of danger when you have to flee, that you think about, you know, what to take. It has to be something incredibly important. And I just find when I ask refugees, it's extremely telling. It's often either something that's going to be extremely useful to them in their journey, or it's something very sentimental.
So did you ask Doa that question?
I did ask Doa that question, yes. And she had a little bit more time. She didn't have to rush, but she could only take one suitcase. So she did take a lot of little small trinkets that, you know, meant something to her over her childhood. And had to leave behind some heavy things like books. But there were also some pieces of clothes that were really important for her to pack. But it definitely was difficult to make the decision. She was very convinced that her departure from Syria at that point was only going to be temporary. So she was hopeful that she was going to be able to return back to her town, her community, her apartment, and her bed.
She is a remarkable young woman. Tell us a little bit about Doa herself.
Well, she's a quite headstrong and stubborn young woman, too, which, in many ways became something, a strength in her personality. It probably helped her in her survival at many points, but it also made her stand out a little bit. She was determined that she wasn't going to be like the other girls who were just going to get married and have babies. She wanted to study. When the war broke out, she was absolutely determined that she was going to be out there protesting in the streets no matter what the danger. And also, when she was a refugee and her soon-to-be fiancé was in hot pursuit of her, it took him a long time. It was very Shakespearean how it took a very, very long time for him to convince her and win her over.
Let's go back a bit, because you start the book by really talking about the roots of the Syrian crisis. I found it very interesting that you include environmental issues at the root of this. So I wonder if you could tell us, how did the Syrian crisis develop?
Well, there are lots of theories, including that environmental issues, a drought, had something to do with it, because during the drought, there were scores of people who started, farmers who started to move to the cities and weren't finding their livelihoods there. And so there was an edginess, more disgruntlement among the population when actually the Arab Spring started happening around, and they were watching their television screens and thinking, wow, I wonder if this could happen in Syria. And all of a sudden, the oppression didn't seem so daunting that they thought maybe, well, we could go out and express ourselves too and ask for things of our government that we never dared to. So this is what Doa witnessed. What's remarkable about Doa's story is that she was actually in the town where the war was sparked, and she knew and witnessed a lot of the events that transpired that turned it from peaceful protest to armed conflict.
And she joined the peaceful protests herself. Tell us a little bit about her work there. I mean, just the indomitable courage that she had, and also a little bit about her family and their reaction to this.
Well, Doa came from a very simple, poor family. Her father was a barber. There were seven children. Very tight, very close, very happy family, not a political family at all. But she just had this sense of right and wrong and justice and injustice. And when she witnessed her government firing on peaceful protesters, she was so determined that this was wrong and that she wanted to be a part of a new movement in Syria. And so she insisted on going out, and even in small ways, she would spend hours in the evenings making beads the color of the revolution, the little bead bracelets that she would hand out. And she'd go out to the protests when she was allowed, and that was, during the afternoons with her friends, and just basically take part, play roles. She even, would throw grenades back that were, rolling towards them. So she had various roles, cutting up onions to help mitigate the effects of the tear gas. And so she did this day after day until it became too dangerous and her father started to say no.
And her father had his own business in Syria. The family wasn't rich, but they were not poor either.
Syria was a place that had a very strong infrastructure. The schools were good. The medical care was good. So, if you had a place to work, you could pretty much support your family. There was certainly plenty of vegetables and fruit and to feed people. The prices were not that expensive. So, yes, they lived, they didn't live an extravagant life, but they had a decent home and they had plenty to eat. And they had, kind of a wonderful community. It all came crashing down with the war, of course, and very literally when a bomb hit his shop, and then his entire livelihood was lost.
So they had to flee to Egypt.
Yeah, well, it was really the last resort. But I think mostly Doa's father, more than anything, was worried about his girls. because there were rumors going around that young women were being abducted, kidnapped, raped, and that was, he couldn't even bear the thought of that happening to his daughters. And so he and his wife decided that they had to go. And they were, you know, pretty much among the first wave of refugees in 2012 that left. They had a connection to Egypt, and so they just decided to go there. And there was the government in power then under Mohamed Morsi, the Muslim Brotherhood, was very welcoming towards Syrian refugees. So when they arrived, actually, not just other refugee families welcomed them into their new communities, but also the locals, the local government, you know, provided help and welcome to the Al-Zamal family.
So that began to change. Why did that change? Well, first, why were they so welcomed into Egypt at first? And then what made the situation change so drastically?
Well, there was a coup d'etat, and the current president, who's still president today, Sisi, associated Syrian refugees with the former government, with the Muslim Brotherhood government. And there were all kinds of not very nice things said, even on national television. And it seemed from one day to the next, the kind of feeling of welcome when they walked down the street, the smiles had turned to either silence or even the feeling of real hostility. And the girls also started feeling that they were being harassed. And you know, this was politicizing refugees when actually they were just there seeking refuge and respite from the awful conflict that they fled from.
So this is a real, I mean, as we're seeing so much right now in the United States as well, the politicization of refugees is such a striking problem. Before we go back to the story of Doha, I wonder if you could talk, just from the point of view of your position at the UNHCR, about this politicization of refugees worldwide and how, you know, how you feel about it.
Well, it really worries us when refugees who are basically the people, what we call them very often is the most vulnerable people in the world. I mean, these are people who are actually fleeing from violence, fleeing from terrorism, and then they're being accused of being associated with that very violence and terrorism. And we just believe this is a complete false narrative. It's done very often to provoke the fear that might be underlying in voters and to achieve a cheap way of getting votes. Refugees, for example, coming to the United States are the most vetted human beings that would ever enter our country. So it actually doesn't make sense to associate them with any danger at all, frankly. So we honestly believe it is rather irresponsible, and the people who are the refugees who we care for all the time are the ones who need actually our sympathy. They need our access to just a place to be free of violence until they can go home. And that's what most refugees want to do anyway.
And you tell that story of that vulnerability so powerfully in this book, Melissa Fleming, in this book, A Hope More Powerful Than the Sea, The Journey of Doha Al-Zamal. Back to Doha, she meets the love of her life. His name is Bassem. You've already spoken a bit about him, about how he wooed her very determinedly. Tell us a little bit about Bassem.
Well, Bassem was also from Dara, where Doha was from, but they didn't know each other. And they ended up in the same pretty much building block in Egypt. And the first time he saw her, it was just love at first sight for him. She had no interest in him whatsoever, nor did she have any interest in any man. But he was just completely taken, and he had just come out of Syria. He didn't talk much about what happened to him, but it was clear that he had been imprisoned by the government and that he had been tortured. And what he wanted now was just some light in his life, and that's what he saw in Doha. And she, unfortunately, just thought that this was just nothing for her right now. It wasn't the time for love. But he pursued her, and he tried every trick, including wooing her mother, her sisters, and and always being there to help when things were going wrong. And it seemed that one day she saw the light and recognized that he really was the one for her.
And he despaired at one point and told her he was going to go back to Syria.
Well, that, I think, is what really switched her, because she realized that she probably was kind of enjoying this courtship and that she probably did have feelings for him that she was not admitting. And when he finally said, you know what, Doa, I see that I'm giving up. I'm going back to Syria. I'm going back to fight. And she thought that not only would she lose him, but she might even be responsible for his death. That's when she completely changed and said, okay, I'm reconsidering. And maybe you can go ask my dad for my hand in marriage.
He wanted to flee Egypt. At first, she did not want to do that. Why did he want to go? What were her hesitations? And then why did she ultimately agree to go with him?
Well, I mean, one of the things that I think this book shows is what a struggle refugee life is for the Syrian refugees living in the neighboring countries of Syria. And that is because, I mean, these countries themselves are hosting so many refugees, have their own economic issues. But also, you know, my organization, UNHCR, is chronically underfunded. So the refugees there are really living hand to mouth. And Bassem and Doa were working kind of labor jobs. And, you know, he was, you know, coming home covered in coal and then having to go out and work again in the evening. And he just thought, this is no life for me. And he was getting messages from his friends on Facebook who had decided that they were going to go to Europe and try to restart their lives there. And they had made it. And they were photos of them in front of one in front of a university in Amsterdam and another talking about his work and his job in Germany. And so he said, Doa, you know, if we go there, then we can not just live in safety, but we can restart our lives. You can study, I can work. And she, though, was absolutely adamant that she wasn't going to do this. She was terrified of the water. She had a near drowning experience as a 6-year-old, never learned to swim. And she was also not naive about the dangers. Nevertheless, you know, the smugglers convinced them they would be on a really safe, not quite a luxury liner, but a safe boat, and it would take them to Italy, and then they could move upwards to the north of Europe. So finally, she let herself be persuaded.
This is a harrowing section of this book. I'll leave some of it to the imagination of the reader, because I think it really has to be read to get the full understanding of what happened. But I'd like you to talk a bit about the smuggling itself, just the conditions of people who are escaping, not just Doa and Bassem, but all the other people. What is the process of them contacting smugglers? Who's running these smuggling operations? What kind of people are they?
Well, it's a thriving criminal business that is exploiting the desperation of refugees and really exploiting them. And these are people who have absolutely no regard for human life. They take their money. They take lots of money. In Doa and Bassem's case, it was $2,500 each, which was for them, you know, it was beyond, it was everything they had. And said they sold off a lot of things too. And, you know, they take the money, and they also then put them on pretty much unseaworthy. If the boats are seaworthy, then they're overcrowded to the extent that they're just dangerous and ready to capsize. And, you know, last year on the Mediterranean Sea, 5,000 people died. 5,000 people drowned. And already this year, the numbers are well over 2,000 who have drowned trying to cross to Italy. So it's a business that is ruthless, and it's there to collect money and has no regard for what happens to the men, women, and children who they put on these rickety boats.
2,000 people have died already, and we're only at the beginning of March?
Yes, that's right. And then now the season is going to start where more and more people will be, you know, setting sail. So, yes, so already more than 2,000 people have died so far this year. And we fear that, you know, with the spring coming and more people taking to the boats, the death toll is going to continue to go up.
And also talk about the pirates.
Well, You mean with the what happened with the ramming of the boat?
Yeah.
They weren't really necessarily pirates. They looked like pirates to Doa. They were probably part of this smuggling gang, and probably they calculated that they'd already, you know, earned $1 million off the backs of the 500 people on that boat and didn't really want to take the responsibility, or no one will ever know why they did it, because there was never any international investigation. But in any case, they rammed this boat intentionally, according to all the survivors I've spoken to, yelled as the boat was sinking, "Let the fish eat your flesh," and were laughing as the boat was sinking to the bottom of the sea, with everybody below deck instantly doomed. So these were people who wanted to see all those refugees die in front of them.
I'm just speechless, really, at the thought of this evil. And yet this is really also part of a larger system. It's not just the pirates who are doing evil, but a whole system that makes their work possible.
Well, you know, where people are desperate, there'll always be criminal networks that will exploit desperate people. I think that the goal is for the world to remove this need for people to have to risk their lives across the seas to reach a safe place. Obviously, you know, more needs to be done to stop the wars that are driving so many people from their homes. But also, you know, more investment in the neighboring countries that are hosting 86% of the world's refugees. Invest in those countries, help them with their infrastructure so that they can continue to host so many. And also, one of the things that really strikes me is that there are just not enough schools for the kids. And this is what was one of the main drivers of many refugee families coming to Europe. They said, look, I couldn't put my kids in school, and I want them to have a future. So that's why I'm coming here. And for me, that's, as a mother, that's a perfectly reasonable argument. If I couldn't put my kids in school, maybe one year I could tolerate it. But year after year, and then no hope of going back to Syria in sight, that is a compelling reason. So I think there are lots of ways that we could ensure that the smuggler business loses its business model. There are other ways, and that's UNHCR's resettlement program, which vets refugees who are living in neighboring countries and allows them to come on airplanes and resettle in communities in countries that have the capacity, including the United States, to take them in. So more of that would really help alleviate or stop the smuggler business.
And yet none of that is happening. If anything, it seems that the world is closing its borders. What is the situation now for refugees who do make it across the Mediterranean?
It's looking pretty grim these days. So if they do make it across, many of them are stuck in Greece because there's no chance for them really to move on anywhere else. Europe has sent a signal, you know, please don't come here. The only way, and most people don't know this, for a refugee to seek asylum in Europe is to actually physically arrive in that country. You cannot ask for asylum in an embassy. So they really do not have a choice if they want to ask for asylum in Europe, but to try to get there. So the journey has become very difficult. Walls have gone up and other restrictions are in place. And so, yeah, we are seeing fewer and fewer Syrians and Iraqis attempting the journey, but there are still many, many others who are.
So they are stuck in countries which are overflowing with refugees, don't have the resources to integrate them, where there are growing tensions of their own. They make a harrowing journey, often losing their lives or their members of their family, and then find a cold welcome on the other side. This is unsustainable.
It is unsustainable. And Europe is, you know, aware of this. And there are lots of meetings and conferences and good minds who are putting their heads together and thinking about how we can improve the situation for refugees while working on peace and while sharing the responsibility. Unfortunately, not all the governments in Europe are willing to share responsibility. Countries like Germany Austria and Sweden, you know, took in the vast majority of the refugees that were coming to Europe. And the expectation was that other countries would do the same. And had they done the same, there would not be any talk of a Europe crisis, because the numbers would have been distributed in a way that it would not have really been noticeable. But because those three countries took on almost all the refugees, it just did become a crisis. And it became a political issue in those countries and around Europe.
Why is peace so elusive in Syria? Because, you know, it's not just the government fighting against the opposition. There are a whole lot of other countries, including the United States and Russia and Turkey, that have gotten involved. Why do they get involved, and what's the way out?
Oh, you're asking the toughest question ever. The war has become very complex, as you said. First of all, internally, the number of actors has, you know, mushroomed. It's no longer, you know, the Free Syrian Army against the government. That is long ago. You have other, many other armed groups, including the likes of, you know, ISIS and al-Nusra. And so then you have the countries in the region and also globally, the world powers, who are supporting different sides. So until the international community comes together and agrees on a way to put a stop to this war, and it stops becoming a kind of proxy conflict as well, you know, people are a bit skeptical about whether we will achieve peace anytime soon. We always have hope. There are efforts ongoing at the United Nations. Talks have started and resumed in Geneva now. And I think everybody is tired of this war, and everybody wants to find a solution. But of course, as the longer any war goes on, the more complex it becomes and the more difficult it is to achieve peace.
There are many people here in the United States who are organizing to support, who mobilized against the ban on Muslim countries, people coming from Muslim countries. What are some of the best ways that ordinary citizens can step up to the plate to support their fellow human beings who are refugees?
You know, I'm always so encouraged when I go back home. I'm American, and I go and visit communities and see what they're doing for refugees. In fact, American communities have been welcoming refugees for decades, and they continue to want to do so. And I think you see, you know, after the ban, some of the biggest resistance were in those very communities that had the most refugees being resettled there, because they saw the success of it. They liked the resulting multiculturalism, the resulting economic stimulation in many places. There's a lot of proof of that. And they felt good, and the people I talked to felt good about bringing in families who had survived war and really just needed a place to restart their lives, and helping them to do so. That's what felt like being American was. This is something that the United States has done over time, and we have so many successful and wonderful former war refugees who are now, you know, just part of the fabric of our society. So we very much hope that this tradition will continue.
And you say the UNHCR is in desperate need of funds. Is that something that ordinary people can help as well?
Absolutely. And UNHCR, we'd love it when ordinary people donate, and it doesn't even have to be that much. It can be just, you know, $10 a month, and that really, really helps us help refugees, you know, where they are, in parts of the world that are distant from us, but are struggling to help these people at their time of most desperate need.
So if folks do want to do that, and I count myself among them, where do we go to donate?
So for your tax-deductible donation to UNHCR in the United States, and also just to learn more about how you can help, you can go to unrefugees.org. Very much appreciated.
Well, that's great. Melissa Fleming, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. Your book, it's such a powerful book. A hope more powerful than the sea, one refugee's incredible story of love, loss, and survival. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Francesca.
Melissa Fleming is a spokesperson for the UNHCR. You can see her TED Talk about the refugee crisis by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, acts of heroism in an earlier conflict. We talk with Alan First about his latest thriller, A Hero of France. It's about a French resistance network whose mission was to save British pilots downed in France and get them back to England for further action. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Alan First has made a living writing terrific thrillers about Europe before and during World War II. His Night Soldiers series began in 1988, and his latest, A Hero of France, clocks in at number 14. It's about the resistance networks in France that rescued downed British airmen and spirited them over the borders to neutral countries so they could get back to their bases in England. It centers on one such network run by the mysterious Mathieu, who confronts a series of unfortunate events in his fight to do his bit against the German military occupation. Grounded as it is in one historical moment, A Hero of France also has salience for our own time, as Americans see a growing threat of authoritarianism in our own country and confront choices about risk and resistance, whether that means that we'll be setting up networks for refugees in our country is still not entirely known, but it could be coming. I spoke with Alan First in his writing studio in Sag Harbor, New York, about his book, A Hero of France, his work, and the relevance of the history in his books to today. I started out by asking him, what was it about the situation in France in 1941 that made him want to write about it?
What I discovered, I had made some reference to the French resistance in other books, but the fact of the matter is, the French stole the phrase French resistance. It was as nothing compared to what went on in Greece, as to what went on in Italy, as to what went on in all kinds of other places, full-fledged, brutal, murderous war. Whereas Hitler wanted Paris and France to be like a playground for German soldiers. And the idea was, well, this is what you get for fighting in the Wehrmacht. You get to go to Paris for a week. You get to play with the girls. You get to go to the bars. You get to eat the fabulous food, see the beautiful art. So he kept it that way. He didn't want it changed. Every movie theater had to stay open. There was no closing the movie theaters. So in that milieu, yes, there was French resistance, a lot of it in 44. As the D-Day landings were prepared. A lot of valiant French people, a lot of people were killed, all kinds, and on and on. But early on, no. The French, and I lived in Paris for 10 years, the French had a philosophy called attentisme, which means waiting. And this is what they determined to do, to wait for the Americans to show up and save them, as they had in 1917.
Wow. So this whole image of blowing up the railways, and I mean, some of that must have happened, but
it did happen, but it happened later, and it didn't happen early. And the thing about the French is that from 1940 May, when France surrendered, which they should not have done, they had a million troops in Africa. They had all kinds, they had a fleet. They might have had to retreat from mainland France or down to the south somewhere, but they folded. They couldn't stick it, and they just they crumbled. They were the victims, and this is another book of mine called Mission to Paris. Mission to Paris is about political warfare with exactly what we're experiencing right now, and France was destroyed. France was destroyed in the 1930s. The Germans came in, bought all newspapers, bought radio stations, did all that kind of stuff, and established certain political ideas. For example, it was the French right who said, no, we don't want to build weapons. That's going to make Hitler mad and he'll invade us. So there was a kind of an anti-war movement among right-wing French people. Basically, they don't want their country destroyed. I don't blame them. Mm-hmm. They have only some German general to thank that the place wasn't blown up as the occupation force left, because he was instructed to do that. But Hitler told him, go. They had the whole thing wired. They had, you know, the Pont Neuf and all these other places, the Louvre, wired.
Really?
Yeah. All they needed, you know, was to pump a few of those old-fashioned exploder things, whatever they're called. But the general, bless his heart, may his tribe live on in happiness, didn't do it. And then what happened? All right, the Germans said, look, we're leaving. We don't want to fight you. We don't want to get people killed. Just let us go. We're going to get in our trucks and our tanks, and we're going east.
When was this?
44. Paris had been reoccupied, so it had to be August. Mm-hmm. So sometime right around then. Mm-hmm. So our good old pals in the French Communist Party were not going to be without martyrs. So they started shooting at the Germans, and the Germans shot back and killed a few of them. You walk around Paris, you'll see plaques, and it says here, Samuel Tichelman, 19 years old, died August 28th, 1944, something like that. It was the Communist Party that decided that it needed to have martyrs, that there was no way that they were going to allow the Germans to leave without giving them some martyrs to have. I have photographs of what the French resistance barricades looked like. It's a joke.
So now in this is titled your latest book, Alan First, A Hero of France, and Mathieu, who is your protagonist, is a hero, not a fake one.
No.
Tell us what he's involved with, and I'm not sure you actually ever really say why he got into it. So maybe give us a little bit of the backstory in your own mind.
Well, the whole point of that book, and Mathieu is a character, you never find out until the last page who he was and what he did. And guess what? It doesn't matter. You know, it's not that he did something amazing. He was a person who cared and protected. There are those among us, saints. I don't know. You know, they're around. They're people who care about other people, really care, and really try to help them, and most importantly, try to protect them. And that's what this guy did. But then all of this happened a little bit by accident, because the French didn't do anything until 41. They sat there for about 8 months. Mm-hmm. After June of 40, into the spring of 41. And then, at that point, the British bombing campaign intensified. Wait, mm-hmm. I'll read it. I have it in the book. There's a good description, because I usually like to have an epigraph of some kind, mm-hmm. but with this book, I had to simply explain what was going on, because people have certain assumptions about the French resistance. You can see them. There they are, you know, in their berets, fixing the dynamite on the railroad tracks. Yeah, that's fine, but talk to the Greeks, talk to the Poles. You want to see who really had resistance and what it cost and how bad it was. But this is the epigraph. In the spring of 1941, as British bombing raids over Germany intensified, some of the returning aircraft, badly damaged and losing altitude, managed to escape German territory, their pilots and crews parachuting into the occupied zone of France. Here they were hidden until they made contact with small groups of French men and women who had organized escape lines that led out of the country and eventually back to England. This was the beginning of what came to be known as the French Resistance.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Alan First about his latest book, A Hero France. It's the 14th in his series about World War II, the Night Soldiers series.
Right, so it was all really about saving British airmen. Why?
In other words, they would get them over the Pyrenees into Spain, where there were British agents who would get them up to Lisbon, and from Lisbon you could get a ship back to England, London, Britain, wherever it went. But you didn't get off there and go back to your wife and children and live happily ever afterwards. You got right back in the cabin of a Lancaster bomber and went back bombing. And this time, maybe you wouldn't have your parachute. I mean, a lot of people died that way. It was the second, third time that they'd been shot down. But the odds were terrible against them. Odds were in general terrible against people who flew those bombing raids.
So you're saying really they were viewed as weapons, the airmen.
They were. A pilot? Do you know a pilot, a fighter pilot or a bomber pilot? That's a weapon. The reason things got so bad for Germany and Japan toward the end of the war, they were out of pilots.
Yeah, so that really answers a question I didn't know I had, because I know also in Holland they were also saving airmen. I mean, the whole idea about saving British airmen, right. I always thought about it as saving the guys, but you're really talking about this as a war issue.
No, I mean, yes, I think it says in the book, the way it's put is, but this could have been done for humane purposes, but 1941 was not a very humane year in Europe. You know, I mean, it's a little ironic in a way, but it's true. No, there was a reason for this. A trained bombardier, a trained engineer, a trained gunner, aircrew, very, very valuable. A lot of hours to train a pilot. I think at the beginning of the war, the Brits had 700 pilots. That's not 10,000. And on that basis, they fought the Battle of Britain.
Now, there's also a character, he's a minor character in your book, but he's there nonetheless, Daniel. He is a Jew.
Right.
And he is also a member of the resistance. How many Jews were part of the resistance in France? I mean, not a number, but was this a common thing?
I don't know. And I gotta tell you, the books about this are academic and impossible, argumentative and butt-covering and just every kind of twist, wiggle this way and that way. You know, it's called Never finished my PhD. It's not for me. My answer is I don't know. Mm-hmm. There was a big transport out of the Marais in 42 of Jews, but those were Polish Jews. And if you look at, I'm going to forget her name. She's a fabulous historian, and she wrote a book about the Jews of Europe and what became of them. Lucy Davidovich, and in this book she talks about and goes through all the countries of Europe and what became of their Jews. And she has a table, And one of the things that's an entry on that table is that France saved 75% of her Jews.
And how did that happen?
They hid some. It was hard for the Germans to find out who was a Jew. Huh. Well, how do you know?
Well, I know in Holland they had a population registry. They used that.
Right, but guess what? Some of these registries disappeared. And so, you know, and on and on. They did every French trick in the book, and they protected the Jews. And a lot of them were protecting their friends, people who worked in the same business as they did, people they'd known for years and years. They were close.
Well, this is interesting because I thought that there was a fair amount of anti-Semitism before the wars. So can you reconcile this?
There were right-wing, crazy people. I mean, you know, they would fit right in today. They were out of their minds, and they hated Jews, and they put themselves as the head of Jewish commissions or whatnot. But it wasn't the whole country. Mostly the French really don't care. I think that's what, you know, they're not Philo-Semitic at all, but neither are they anti-Semitic. One of the most famous remarks on this subject comes not from France, but from Italy. And at a certain point, Mussolini made a speech, you know, after Hitler bothered him and pressed him and this and that. And Mussolini says, the Jews must be gotten out of Italy. There's a bad influence. And all the people went, yeah, that's right. And then they turned to each other and they said, who's a Jew? They had no idea.
I spent some time in southern France, and I remember a friend of mine there said to me, who's French, who said, talking about the Vichy government, which you should explain for our listeners, and he said, well, you know, Marshal Pétain, who was the head of that government, delivered the Jews on a silver platter to the Germans. So there was a very different...
Yes, he did. But they weren't on the silver platter.
Even in Vichy?
There was no play. Vichy was not a place. It was an idea. It was supposed to be when the Germans divided the country in two, because they did not want to fight their way all the way down to the Alps, to the Pyrenees. They just didn't want to do that. It would have cost them a lot of people to do that fighting. The French army wasn't all that bad. They were very crippled because of what went on in the 30s. They didn't have the right planes. Their tanks weren't any good because of this anti-militaristic thing. There's a lot of people that sabotage that country. On the right wing sabotaged the French military effort because, like Pétain, they felt that France was immoral. Too much smoking, too much drinking of wine, too much lovemaking. That's what they thought, and that's what Pétain thought. He wanted to repurify France as though it had ever been pure. Anyhow, they had this government in Vichy, and Vichy made rules, and it got tangled up this way and that way and the other way. But the Germans didn't want to try to govern the French. So what they did was they had an occupied zone in the north, Paris, and a lot of the French industry was up north. They made a line at the Loire, and below that line, Vichy was in charge, which means that you didn't get arrested so quickly, if at all.
But there were plenty of French Jews who ended up in German concentration camps.
Oh, yes, there were. Yes, there were, but more Dutch, more Romanian, more, you name it, you know, Hungarian. That didn't happen in France. It happened other places, but it didn't happen in France.
So now back to this book, A Hero of France. In this, you write about the resistance. There's actually an interesting character in this book who's German. He's a German policeman, and he is sent into France to break up these networks of rescuing the British airmen. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about why did you include him? He's not such a bad guy.
No, he's not. I mean, I think somewhere in the book you have an SS guy. And those people were out of their minds. Mm-hmm. They were having a wonderful time, but they were out of their minds. The actual people who did the work, Gestapo and what have you, and I've done this in other books, those were cops. That's who does that work. And they were not political cops. They were cops who were told, here are your orders, put on this uniform, go here, go there, do this, break up this group of people. Okay. You know, they were German cops. You know, they came from Hamburg and other places. What are you going to have somebody in, if tomorrow they put you in the SS, would you know how to investigate and find out somebody who was anti-American and should be imprisoned? Would you? Could you? No, of course not. You have to have the people who already do that. So that's kind of how that worked.
Now, when I first took a look at this book and read some of the publicity materials about it, Alan First, they talked about some of the parallels between a rise of authoritarianism, the way you write about the rise of authoritarianism, not just in this book, but in other books as well, and what may or may not be going on today. And I wonder if you could, with all the breadth of the research and the knowledge, the in-depth knowledge that you have developed over these decades of writing these wonderful books about pre-World War II and World War II, if you could talk a little bit about the historical parallels to today.
Well, what happened in Germany happened here. The Germans didn't hate Jews. You know, Jews were a very honored part of Germany. They were important. They had won big medals in World War I. They were cultural leaders. They did things the Germans liked. They played cellos and things like that. But along about 1929, the United States had a depression, and that meant they couldn't continue to provide defeated Germany from 1918 with bridge loans until Germany got back on its feet. That's what we were doing in the U.S. because Versailles was a terrible treaty. It really created another war, and that was really, in a way, the fault of the French, Clemenceau, and But the United States banks stepped in and started loaning Germany money. And that was fine until 29. Then in 29, with the crash, Germany crashed. The German economy crashed. People lost businesses that had been in their families for 300 years. People committed suicide like you wouldn't believe. You know, Europeans are a little different than Americans. The American personality is supple. If you get knocked down, you're supposed to get back up again. In Europe, people they shatter when things like this go wrong, and they don't recover from it. It's not like they can go get another job if they're 35. You can't. I mean, you know Europe well enough to know how that is. Even it's like that now. And it was certainly like that then. So then all these people are suffering and going without food, and everything's terrible. And along comes this little man, Adolf Hitler, and he says, "We're going to put Germany back to work. That's all we're going to do. We're going to recover from this terrible war we lost, or the Jews lost for us, you know, the Dolstoss, the stab in the back and all that." So they voted for the Nazi Party. Hitler was voted into office. Mm. Now, admittedly, once he got there, he wasn't going to get out anytime soon. That's not going to happen here.
You really don't think so? I mean, I think that's some of the fear.
You're kidding, man. Oh, my God. Talk about blood in the streets. Please don't even think about it.
Really? Why do you think that there couldn't be some kind of... I mean, after all, the president of the United States, it's not just the president. There's the Congress, now the Supreme Court. I mean, all the checks and balances are kind of going away. You don't think that there would be a possibility at least of a takeover of the U.S. government and kind of the end of voting, or even if there was voting, it would be preserved like it is in other, you know, dictatorships.
You mean Trump would become a dictator?
Well, kind of Putin-esque strongman.
I don't think so.
So why not?
Because There are no more freedom-loving people than Americans. Americans take this very personally. They are not like Europeans in this regard. Europeans go, well, there are always limits. You have to do what you have to do. You can't always do what you want. You have to go along with the program, you know, etc. Americans, no, man. Oh, my God. They're already in the streets. But they're in the streets with banners. They could have worse things to be in the streets with. Do you know how many guns there are in this country? You really don't want a civil war here or another one. The first one was bad enough. I believe the second one, that would be the end of it. No, that's a terrible idea. No, we're a democracy. And we uphold certain... It's really served us well. So things haven't happened here. We haven't had dictators. We've had some presidents who exceeded their authority by a little bit, but not a lot. They're not going to say voting in America is over, no more democracy. There's some guy in France now saying that.
But you know, well, there's voter suppression. I mean, there has been a lot of move against democracy, but you're saying you feel that the value of democracy is too much ingrained in Americans.
It is, believe me. Believe me, go to the elementary schools and ask the kids what's going on. They'll tell you.
So, and another question, you said, you know, in the 1930s in Germany, you know, people didn't have resilience, that, you know, they went with the scapegoat. Has there been a loss of resilience also in this country, do you feel, that has allowed people to, you know, vote in?
It's the same. Now, it used to be, in the America that I grew to love as I went through high school and college, that's like 60s. Now, it would be great to have an interesting job. But if life didn't work out that way, well, then you'd have to work for the phone company, or you'd have to work for the post office, or you'd have to do this, or you'd have... Gone. That's gone. And that's dangerous. You must give people a way out of the trap that they see themselves in, or they will do mischief.
So, just as a last question, then, you've done how many of the, how many books, 14 books?
Writing number 15 now.
Oh, you are writing number 15. Mm-hmm. Do you ever share anything? No, you don't. All right, but tell us, what a about A Hero of France, what questions did it bring up for you in terms of propelling you to your next book, even though you don't want to reveal what that book is about?
Oh, I just like the idea. It's a very old-fashioned idea in fiction and novels of the savior, of a guy or woman, because there are a lot of strong women in this book, people who take it upon themselves to fight against evil.
Well, Alan, first, your latest book is A Hero of France. It's a terrific read, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thank you for having me.
Alan First, his latest book in the Night Soldier series is A Hero of France. It's just out in paperback, published by Random House. And you can read an excerpt by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.